We are now going to begin letter number 19 in the 19 letters series. And this letter is entitled The Essays. I would like to dedicate this shiur to all of us followers of Rav Hirsch who are single and are searching for their spouses. And I hope that this shiur will be a merit for us to speedily find our matches. And it will become obvious why this letter works for that purpose. Now Rabbi Elias, in his introduction, writes that Naftali tells Benjamin that he has agreed to write a work about Yisrael and its duties, and that the work will have two parts. One will deal with general principles, and the other one will deal with the commandments. And the second part, which is the work called Chorev, is already prepared, and it will be published first since, according to Rav Hirsch, the central problem that was being had during his time was the misinterpretation and the rejection of mitzvos. So let us begin. You have prevailed, my dear Benjamin, on the day on which you are consecrating a wife for yourself to establish with her a home in Yisrael. I am offering you the one gift which you requested, the granting of your long and often expressed wish. If God will give me understanding and good health, I intend to lay upon the altar of my people the only offering which it is in my limited power to present. I do not really share the sanguine expectations for it with which you welcome this decision. Sanguine means optimistic or hopeful. I do not imagine that those ideas which I communicated to you, and which I love and treasure in my innermost heart, will necessarily be accepted as the truth by everyone, just because you accept them as the truth with such warm enthusiasm. Nor can I, indeed, presume them to be the pure gold of absolute truth. I know my own limitations and the character of our age too well to be enticed by such hopes. But I believe that, in a time of such profound significance, and for a cause which is to us the most sacred, it is every man's duty openly and honestly to express what he sees as the truth. Indeed, my friend, I would consider my work amply rewarded, even if I succeeded only in demonstrating that the subject has not yet been thoroughly investigated in all its aspects, and that there is perhaps a way that leads to entirely different conclusions, another point of view perhaps, which might put everything in a different light from the one now taken for granted. If I succeeded only in arresting just one hand that has been raised too rashly for the self-appointed task of tearing down and rebuilding anew, and I thus cause its owner to reconsider, if I made no other contribution to the ultimate goal, which I have described to you, than paving the way for somebody else more talented, better equipped, brighter and stronger, who would present a much truer, loftier, more luminous and more vital picture of Judaism, so that my own feeble attempts would only be pitied and forgotten. You suggest that it was my diffidence means hesitance, that caused me to delay this task for so long, since the necessity for it must surely have long occupied me. I have indeed felt the need for such a work for a long time, as proven to you by the accompanying sheaf of essays about Yisrael and its duties, or rather, only about its duties. The essays about Yisrael itself exist as yet only in an outline, and that only in my mind. Yes, I have indeed been diffident, and I still am, not for myself, however, but on account of the cause which I try to represent. In an age when opposites confront each other, and truth is on neither side, a man who belongs to no party, who has only the cause at heart and serves it alone, cannot expect agreement from any side. And we discussed how Rav Hirsch was attacked both from the left and the right, and that he was aware that this would happen, unless he were the divinely guided master who comprehends the divine truth in absolute purity and is able to show it so brilliantly in its divine radiance that all minds and hearts subdued render homage to it. I knew and know this to be so, yet despite this knowledge, I began to write these essays. It is not fame or personal recognition that I am seeking. Otherwise, surely, the critical judgment which I can expect from the multitude will be quite in place. He knows very little about the world and his time, and what they want. but I do not seek the approval of the masses. What prompts me is solely the inner voice which, though I test it over and over again, keeps reaffirming to me, your views hold something of the truth, something of that truth which you believe must ultimately emerge victoriously into the light. It is the inner voice which assures me, the road on which you set out may be only a bypath, but it leads in the right direction. And if someone more able than you will follow in your footsteps, the cause of truth can only gain by it. This alone is the call that has spurred me on, for surely, my friend, is not one grain of truth worth the sacrifice of my own person even 1,000 times over? Such personal considerations have never disturbed me. I should just point out that this letter is basically an easy read and pulls together some of the reasons of why Rehfresh wrote the Sefer. However, there are other worries to be weighed. Might I not cause harm instead of helping? I had to find almost entirely by myself, through my own insight, the road to a systematic reconstruction of Judaism as a science. Only along the shorter, easier, and clearer part of the way did a good friend accompany me, and only one star shone before me to guide me in the beginning. Now Rabbi Elias says that this good friend is a reference to the Chacham Bernays, while the one star refers to Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, and both the Chacham Bernays and Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, as we discussed, were Rebbeim of Rav Hirsch. I have had to struggle all by myself to reach the point at which you found me. Thorns and rubble had to be removed at every step on the road. I alone, with limited powers, had to contend with an entire past and present as I silently continued my efforts. Might it not be then that I entered 1,000 torturous side paths, accepted 1,000 errors as truth? Can this edifice, as it exists in my mind, and as I would like to transmit it to my brethren, be free from defects? And suppose my attempts fail? Will not those who would gladly do away with the cause for which I am living use my abortive efforts to strangle this cause entirely? See here, they would gloat, some entirely new attempts to rehabilitate Judaism, total failures. My strength does not lie in writing. Now it's interesting, Rav Hirsch writes this, although he may have felt this way, he was and is known for his masterful and prolific writing, although, as we discussed in the introduction, he was even more known for his oratory skills that, unfortunately, because we don't have recordings, doesn't last. My strength does not lie in writing. All my life, I have engaged in thinking more than in speaking, and in speaking more than in writing. Will I be able to write the truth with all the clarity needed to convince the minds, and with all the forcefulness required to capture the hearts? For one thing, if I want to reach the children of my time, I must write in the German language and in German script. Now, as we discussed in the introduction, in Rav Hirsch's time, that was considered radical. But I realize that, as surely as Judaism, correctly conceived and conveyed, constitutes a bond of love and justice encompassing all creatures, so isolated passages taken out of context, deliberately misinterpreted, not seen as an integral part of the whole structure, have been misused by evil design as pointed arrows or blunt cudgels to oppress and injure helpless victims. Will this be the fate of my essays? Might not someone, pushed aside and offended by such rude insolence, be able to point at me as the cause, albeit innocent? And there are other worries that disturb me. How then, I hear you asking me, have you been able to resolve all these doubts, since after all, you have decided to undertake this work? Having scaled the summit by myself and gained new vistas, I would like to summon companions. I would like to descend and, together with them, retrace the road from the beginning. I want to give over only what I have been able to gather so far, not a finished work, but truly as mere essays. In any case, our cause surely cannot be harmed in the eyes of sensible men because of some unsuccessful endeavors resulting from the wishful imaginings of some immature youth. Finally, I see a child enveloped in flames. The bystanders are afraid. They do nothing. Or else, they are only trying to save the building. I see the child. I rush in. Should I first ask my neighbor whether he too sees the child? Should I worry whether in my haste I am jostling someone, or perhaps hindering the salvage of the building by running in? Perhaps I am causing a draft, fanning the fire. But you might ask, if it should be too late, if the building were to collapse on top of the child in a roaring conflagration before you reached it? Were I to be buried under it, I would at least have done my duty. You are right, dear Benjamin. Ordinarily, one would begin with scholarly investigation and then calmly apply to life those conclusions that had proven true and tenable in the battle of the minds. This would be the more deliberate and more certain and more pleasant route, but our times demand a different course. Now, this is kind of interesting because in reality, this is what Rav Hirsch did in minimal form in the first number of letters that we read, right? Did we not decide to the Torah and we were going to have an investigation? So what exactly is Rav Hirsch referring to here? So if we look in Rabbi Elias in note number 5, he explains a little bit. He writes, in the following paragraphs, the author explains that he decided to publish the second practical part of his work, the Chorev, first. He explains that the issue of immediate burning concern to the Jewish community is a proper understanding of the mitzvos. Some generations earlier, when mitzvah observance was not a problem, it would have been possible to start systematically by first explaining the underlying basic principles of the Torah before proceeding to a discussion of the mitzvos. Today, however, it is the mitzvos that are of primary concern. They are misinterpreted as purely ceremonial laws or are considered outdated in their rationale and therefore are treated as unnecessary. Thus, it is essential to concentrate on them first. Indeed, a case can be made that the Reform movement would never have arisen and developed a new Jewish theology were not for the fact that observance of the mitzvos had been felt to be unduly burdensome in the modern age. Rabbi Elias continues, in fact, Rav Hirsch never wrote the projected first part, which was to be entitled Moriah, even though he was firmly committed to writing it. Indeed, the first part of the Chorev has on the first page the title Moriah and Chorev, and despite the fact that he found time to write so many other major and minor works. So I guess we see from here that when it came to the practical text, Rav Hirsch wanted the practical done, the mitzvos, before he wanted the investigations done. However, in this short book of the 19 letters, he does begin by giving a broad outline of such an investigation. But let's continue. In the days of Mendelssohn, when the stirrings of the spirit were just beginning, but the Jewish way of life was still unimpaired, it would have been possible to develop the systematic understanding of Judaism as a science, and to bring to the Jewish life that still existed everywhere the light and the warmth of the spirit of Judaism. Had that been done, indeed our condition would be different now. But today this approach is no longer possible. Opinions not drawn from authentic Judaism have entered Jewish life. They are hostile to it and seek to undermine it. These views must be combated directly in the midst of life. Only thus will someone who is still observant come to comprehend what it is that he is observing. Someone who is about to reject will pause and examine what it is he is casting away, and some who stand poised, perhaps with honest zeal, to tear down and rebuild, may stop to investigate the deeper value of what they want to demolish and what they want to add to. Later on, it would devolve upon the scholars systematically to formulate in a scientific way the principles that had been proclaimed in life. This is the direction which I intend to take. If heaven grants me health and understanding, I shall try to express the views of Judaism about God, the world, man, Yisrael, and the Torah in the first part. The second part is to explain the mitzvos that we have to fulfill at the present time when we are deprived of our national soil. I will introduce each mitzvah by quoting the pertinent passages in the Torah. Then we'll follow views about the mitzvos, which I have drawn from several years of study. Finally, extracts from the four parts of the Shulchan Aruch will be added for practical application of the laws. All this is to be presented for immediate use in life, as you will see from the second part of the work, which accompanies this letter, which is of course Chorev. The scientific demonstration of its roots, which is the book Moria, which never appeared, in Jewish scholarship will have to be left until later. The first incentive to write these essays came from the need to give the teachers of the schools entrusted to me a book in which they themselves would find their bearings as Jews before beginning to educate young souls for Judaism. I am glad about this, for now, when elaborating my notes for a wider circle, I continue to visualize my readers as thinking young men and women of my people. I intend to publish the second part first, God willing. In principle, you are right, of course, in suggesting that the study of the general concepts should precede that of the particulars, and my work was planned accordingly. Nevertheless, I will let the second part appear first, although I know that it will probably provoke even more opposition. After all, people are readier to accept general principles before they realize the entire range of consequences to which these ideas will logically lead. Yet I cannot do otherwise, because I believe that I have discovered the immediate cause of our present troubles in the false opinions and prejudices regarding the scope, contents, and significance of our mitzvos. It is through these individual misunderstood mitzvos that Yisrael's essence is being misconceived, attacked, and destroyed. Here is where our strength is ebbing away, and here we must rise in opposition. Once we have shown the meaning of Judaism as manifested in its specific ordinances, then we can set our sights higher, and, taking everything together, try to answer the question, what is the place of Judaism as a whole among all other phenomena? What role does it have within mankind? And how does Judaism conceive of mankind's role in the world? What is the role of the world itself as assigned by God? And what does the world in turn teach us about God? Were the first part of my essays to appear first, people would consider all that I have to say about Yisrael to be a dreamer's vision, a figment of fanciful imagination unrelated to reality. Still, in order to provide my readers with at least as much knowledge about the general concepts of Judaism as is necessary to comprehend the particulars, I will begin the second part of my essays with some general outlines, such as I tried to give you in the beginning of our correspondence, the 19 letters. I have also endeavored, in the discussion of every particular mitzvah, to lead the reader toward an interpretation derived from the overall framework of Judaism. So much, perhaps already too much, about this project which you advocated so warmly. What he's saying here is something akin to, so much for this project. If its results will not remain altogether without blessing, remember with joy that you devoted so much enthusiasm to the needs of the community at a time when you might ordinarily have been totally preoccupied with your private life. I'd actually like to read this paragraph from the Drachman edition, because I think it makes more sense and has a little more feeling to it. So much for this project in which you have taken such warm interest. May you, if its results be not altogether without blessing, remember with joy that in a time when your eye could have been turned with so many sweet hopes entirely upon your own individual life, you had so much love for the general and universal. Continuing in the Elias edition, may the day on which you receive these lines be the beginning of a joyful, active future. May the wife whom you will today consecrate unto yourself always remain your most hallowed treasure. May the home that you are founding together be pure, holy, and divinely sustained, just like the cover, adorned with divine symbols, which you wrap around yourselves today. We'll get back to that in a moment. May the cup of life from which you both will drink always contain so much sweetness that you will never despair, and just enough bitterness so that you will not grow arrogant. May you accept all the abundance of blessings as only a means granted you by the hand of God to live a life of righteousness and love. Farewell, dear Benjamin. Your Naftali. And the book ends, Tam v'nishlam shevach l'kel borei olam. There are several things I'd like to go through in this paragraph. Let's work backwards. So in the last sentence we said, may you accept all the abundance of blessings as only a means granted you by the hand of God, and to live a life of righteousness and love. So if we look in note 7, Rabbi Elias writes as follows. Rav Hirsch concludes with what is in effect the theme of this book, the duty of man to serve God by going in his ways and practicing righteousness and love. If we seek to sum up this message, we find that it consists essentially of three points that keep recurring in the 19 letters. 1. Man attains closeness to God by discharging his unique task in God's world, choosing freely to further God's goal for the world by actions of love and justice. The Jew is guided to the appropriate actions by the mitzvos prescribed by the Torah. 2. It follows that the mitzvos are not mere religious ceremonials, but are concerned with the full range of life, for man is supposed to use all his gifts and all circumstances he encounters to serve God through love and righteousness. And 3. It further follows that man must be educated for such a life primarily through knowledge of the Torah's teachings, and secondarily through whatever other knowledge and skills will help him live this kind of life. Okay, so moving backwards, we said, may the home that you are founding together be pure, holy, and divinely sustained, just like the cover adorned with divine symbols which you wrap around yourselves today. Now, the cover refers to a talis, and the divine symbols to tzitzis. Now, this affords me the unique opportunity to discuss briefly one of the German minhagim. And truth be told, this is not an exclusive German minhag. And the cover here, the talis, refers to the ancient Ashkenaz and Sfard minhag as well, to place a talis over the man and the woman as the chuppah, and this is known as chuppah's talis. Now, most people today of Ashkenaz descent have abandoned this chuppah, the real chuppah, the chuppah's talis, for the canopy chuppah, which is a later innovation. But today, when you say chuppah, that's what people think about. And even many Sfardim have kind of backed off of the chuppah's talis. But you find German Jewry still perform marriage ceremonies using the chuppah's talis. And just to give a little bit of background information on this, the very first reference we find to covering one's head with a garment as part of a wedding, we can find in Bereishis, in Chaf Dalet Samach Hei, that would be 2465, it says that Rivka, when she saw Yitzchak, Vatikach Hatzoif Vatiskas, that she took a veil and she covered herself. Now, several of the commentators of the Rishonim hold that placing a garment over the bride and the groom at the chuppah commemorates or reenacts the covering of Rivka's head when she married Yitzchak. Now, this has nothing yet to do with talis. This just has to do with using a garment. Later on in the Torah, we find in Devarim, chapter 23, verse 1, it says, Lo yikach ish es eshes aviv, v'lo yigale kenaf aviv. A man should not take his father's wife, right, his stepmother, and shall not expose or uncover his father's garment. Now, the word uses kenaf. And again, some of the Rishonim understand that this is a reference to the man who spreads his garment over his wife at the chuppah. We find when the Torah discusses a maidservant in Shemos 21:8, the Torah says, Imra'a b'enei Adoneha, asher lo ye'ada v'hefda, la'am nachri lo yimsholim achra bivigdova. Now the Torah here uses the term bivigdova, and some of the Rishonim again understand it to mean that since he spread his garment over her, he's not permitted anymore to sell her. And again, we would say that this serves as a sign of marriage, since when he married her, he spread his garment over her. That's why the Torah uses this language of bivigdova. And we could infer from here that chuppah, and from all these sources, is performed by covering the bride with a garment. And we find a source for this in Megillah as well. Rus asks Boaz to marry her by saying, Uforastach inofecha ala masicha, that you should spread your garment over your maidservant. In Rus, that's in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Tes. And again, this is understood to mean chuppah. If we look in Yechezkel 16:8, Hashem declares to the Bnei Yisrael, Va'efros kinofi alaich, va'achase ervoseich. We see from here that God compares his bond with Bnei Yisrael as the one that is established between a bride and their groom at their wedding. So in this case, Bnei Yisrael is the bride, and we are being covered with a garment. And now the word chuppah too means covering, and if you think of the typical chuppah, it's something which is kind of over you. The chuppah that we're referring to, chuppah's talis, is something which is actually attached to you. It's on you itself. So being that chuppah is a formal act of marriage, what we're referring to here is covering over the bride and the groom with his talis. Now, how do we know this refers to a talis and not some other kind of garment? So here, a number of the Rishonim use a biblical source which juxtaposes two verses together. And it says in Devarim 22, Pasuk Yud Beis, it says, Gidilim ta'aselach al arbak kanfos kesusecha asher techaseba. So that is a pasuk referring to tzitzis. The very next pasuk says, Ki kach ish isha v'ayla usneya, that if a man takes a wife, so the next pasuk is referring to marriage. Now some understand the reason that tzitzis are used is to inspire the chasan and kala to observe the Torah's commandments, which is represented by the talis, and there's a certain dignity given over to the chuppah when you use a talis. And there are some other ideas out there as well. It's supposed to somehow serve to help ensure well-being of their children. I don't know how that works. And there are some other reasons given as well, some of them more Kabbalistic. Now, it used to be, until the year 1349, it was very common that the woman's veil would also go over the chassan's head. So you had her veil over his head, and his talis over her head. And there are various sources given for this as well. But apparently in 1349 there were numerous persecutions, and this custom was forgotten. In some communities, such as Worms, it was replaced in a slightly different manner. But we could say that nobody knows of this anymore, and that the use of spreading a talis with tzitzis over the chasan and kala is something which has been preserved throughout time in Sephardic communities to some extent, and certainly among German communities, Western European Jews, and there are other communities as well which remain committed to preserving our ancient customs. We still use the chuppah's talis as our primary form of making a chuppah. If anyone would like more information on this, check Rabbi Yamin Shlomo Hamburger's work entitled Shor Shei Minhag Ashkenaz, and you can find an entire chapter just dedicated to Chuppah's Talis. So at this point, we are going to conclude letter number 19, and we will hopefully have some concluding shiurim in which we will wrap up some of what we've said and discuss some issues that we haven't really brought up yet.